Again, these four bodhisattva practices are giving, all kinds of generosity and giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and what Dogen calls identity action. And we talked about giving for a while, and last week we talked about kind speech or loving words, and just a little bit more about this speech. This is a nice summary of the Buddha's early teachings on right speech. And it has this flavor of these early sutras where it's like this list of all these different kind of qualities that are almost the same with the slight variations. And this is like what the Buddha speaks and this is what he doesn't speak and so on. But I thought this is kind of practical. What is appropriate speech and what's not for the Buddha? This is in the middle length sayings, sutra number 58. The Buddha says, "Such speech as the Buddha knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Buddha does not utter." You might have guessed. "Such speech as the Buddha knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Buddha does not utter. Such speech as the Buddha knows to be true, correct, and beneficial, but which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, the Buddha knows the time to use such speech." Yeah, so that might be a surprise. Yeah. So if it's true, correct, and beneficial, I think that's the key thing, that it's actually going to benefit, but people maybe don't want to hear it. The Buddha is willing to do that. And he doesn't just say...
Like saving water, we have to save water.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, I don't want to save water. Yeah. So, and it's nice that he's very careful. He says the Buddha knows the time to use such speech, not just like blurts it out all the time. So finding the right time to correct... some action or give some feedback in a careful way at the right time. "Such speech as the Buddha knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, but which is welcome and agreeable to others, he does not utter." And we might say like all kinds of like gossip and stuff, right? Where I love to hear about what so-and-so like did wrong.
Wait a minute, read that again.
People like to hear it, but...
No, I know, but read exactly what it's just for.
So this one is, the Buddha knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial.
Right.
Okay.
But people like it.
But the next one is, such speech as the Buddha knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable to others. What do you think about that?
Does not speak.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Silence is better.
Because it's not beneficial.
It's not beneficial.
I think so. It's true. It's correct. People love to hear it. But it actually isn't really going to benefit them. The Buddha's like, no. Let's skip that one. And, yeah. "With such speech as the Buddha knows to be true, correct, beneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable, the Buddha knows the time to use such speech." Again. So there's only two times the Buddha speaks at all, like if he's following his own advice here, which is when what is being said is true, correct, and beneficial. And then whether or not people like it or not is not the most important thing. In both cases, the Buddha would use such speech at the right time. Why is that? Because the Buddha has compassion for beings.
But there's no time, it just pops off anytime.
Yeah.
I like the fact, too, that it says that the Buddha does not utter. So I just have this image of like all this stuff going through his head.
Yeah, could be.
Like an algorithm.
Yeah, running the formula with these five things. Nope. So I think that's a great exposition of right speech, basically based on benefiting others. And elsewhere when talking about bodhisattva activity, it's said that the long-term benefit of beings is more important than their short-term. So something that might like hurt a little bit at first but will benefit in the long run, like, you know, stitching up a wound or something, you know, might like hurt in the short term, but in the long term it's going to be good. As opposed to like, this will make you happy right now, but actually later on you're going to have big problems. That's generally not so advisable.
If you're looking for something that decides you to make you happy, you've already missed happiness.
Yeah, if there's anything outside, yeah.
Only you can choose to be happy.
Mm-hmm. And then we also talked about last week about with kind speech about the modern practice of NVC, nonviolent communication. And it just occurred to me at the time last week, so I didn't really remember all the details. And I just thought, maybe you all know of this, but yeah, these words.
Oh, right, no.
You know, these are like nonviolent words or kind speech. Right? Again, not this system by Marshall Rosenberg of like how to resolve conflict in negotiations and speech is, I think, just wonderfully effective and very much in accord with Buddha Dharma. And so it's basically this four-step model is expressing observations, feelings, personal feelings, needs, and requests. So the observations is like a specific event, like when you said such and such, I felt, you know, and this is where we have to be careful with these words, to really, how I feel, that's not blaming the other. I felt such and such because I have the need for such and such, and therefore, may I ask you to not say that again. So there's observation, feeling, need, and request. And then you can find all this on those websites, but the feelings inventory for the words that are, which I think is quite hard when I try this out in a difficult situation. Often the word has a slight blaming quality, but there's a whole page of words that don't. And it'd be nice to memorize it or something. There's a whole bunch for like, you know, feelings when your needs are satisfied, like affectionate, confident, engaged, inspired, peaceful, joyful, refreshed. But in fact, I think often when we're using this kind of conversation, we can skip that page. That part's easy, to not use blaming, happy words. But when the needs are not satisfied, there's also a whole page. And there's like, you know, subheadings and then words under them. So like, just to list these main subheadings are, that are, and notice how these words are not blaming another. They're just owning your own state.
Like you wouldn't say, I feel put down.
Yeah, exactly. So afraid, it's okay to say. Afraid, annoyed. It's where it might seem a little close, but if you examine, annoyed doesn't mean that you annoy me, right? I just feel annoyed or frustrated. Right? Angry, averse, confused, disconnected, disquiet, embarrassed, tired, pain, sadness, tense, vulnerable, yearning,
Wouldn't it be incompassionate to choose to feel any of those things?
No, I think actually, I think it's when we do, when those feelings come up, I think to
they
not,
don't.
What's that?
They don't.
But they do sometimes, yeah. I mean, if they do, let's say if they do,
you
even
have
if.
To choose them. To feel them.
Well, I think like we have this teaching of like karma is like that often effects arise due to our past conditioning. So ideally, we're.
That would be delusion.
And sentient beings are often deluded. Even bodhisattvas with the vow to live for the benefit of all beings are deluded until they're irreversible Buddhas, unwavering Buddhas. They're basically deluded, which means there's like the effects of karma are playing out of past conditioning. So maybe they can catch it after, oh, that was really, I was acting out of past habit, and I don't really, I can catch it now and don't really feel that, but.
I think all of those are just fear thought rooted, and if you choose loving thoughts, you are free from all of those.
But again, you check out your own experience. If somebody really provokes you, even if you're choosing loving thoughts, see if they provoke you enough, like take out an axe and come running at you. See.
I've not felt even a hint of anger in over a decade.
That's pretty good.
You haven't been together with the right people.
you've not been married?
I am married.
Oh, and you don't ever feel angry with your wife?
No. My wife occasionally chooses to suffer, but I do not.
I feel occasionally hungry with my husband.
So, I think that's when you say, yeah, I haven't been with the right people. As the bodhisattvas, you know, often, like, they're grateful for, like, really difficult people because they help them to, like, learn the practice of patience. Well, you know, when, if they've completely mastered the practice of patience, then they don't need those people anymore. But you could say, like, if we haven't felt anger, or, you know, anger is maybe a strong word, just even a little tinge of aversion, or how about annoyance? It's not really anger. Well, that's like a little annoying what happened. It's a low-level anger. And then if we're not, then, like, go into a war zone just to like practice our patience.
I've been beaten before, and I'm thankful for all of my experiences, including ones when I was showed cruelty, because without understanding cruelty, I could not appreciate kindness.
Yeah.
You can only have experience it, and then your interpretation makes it good or bad. I choose good interpretation of all experience because it feels uncompassionate to do otherwise.
That's great. May you continue.
Thank you. I plan to.
I think it's so important with this NVC because mm-hmm. I've had really negative experiences with it.
Mm.
I think if it's done with a loving and compassionate and easeful tone,
yeah,
you know, but it can so, I have seen it deteriorate into... Mm-hmm. Your language is wrong. No, you're using the wrong category. No, you know, which absolutely
yeah.
inflames me.
Yeah, well, maybe when we're training with it, we might, if we're taking a class or something, we might have some feedback or something. But I think when we're actually using it, it's like built into the system that if you're choosing the words carefully, even if the tone is not so relaxed or whatever, I think still, at least my understanding, my limited understanding of it is that I think if you follow the principles really closely, it really is quite effective in disarming.
I think if you have access to the list of words.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's when it goes off, is when the words are those edgy words.
So are there words that when you're feeling happy or, you know, positive,
mm-hmm.
are still blaming words? You said
they don't list any blaming. Oh. This is only the good words.
Oh.
But there might be. Yeah, there might be.
You just said that enough to just maybe think that question.
Maybe it would be like, maybe it wouldn't be like violent exactly, but it would still be like putting the emotion on the other person.
Yeah, well, that's which is kind of what an example of that might be talking about.
Yeah, it's kind of like not really owning it completely.
Yeah, because I feel like sometimes I have received a compliment that I thought, really?
Yeah.
And I just...
Yeah, it may not be true, too. Yeah. Under...
That too, yeah.
But then it wasn't really...
Yeah, it didn't feel like really a compliment. Something about it was wrong, and I just was... that's what I was wondering.
Just for some elaborate words under the annoyed and angry headings, just so you hear a few more, in case you ever want to try this. These are non-violent or non-blaming words. They're like owning a feeling. Aggravated, dismayed, disgruntled, displeased, exasperated, frustrated, impatient, irritated, irked. Irritated is... still not meaning that you irritate me. Enraged, furious, incensed, indignant, irate, livid, outraged, resentful. So it's still owning those feelings. And then the needs are common needs are like connection, honesty, play, peace, well-being, meaning, and autonomy. Autonomy is, I think, a nice one. When you're feeling control. You can't really say control isn't the right word. That's blaming, but you're feeling like
a lack of autonomy.
Yeah. You could say that. Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. So that's some of this nonviolent communication. So Dogen is now going on to talk about beneficial action. Or fulfilling aims, or accomplishing the purpose, are other translations from the old sutras, and it's often connected with, as Asanga talks about, inspiring others. This is beneficial action, and so Dogen says beneficial action is skillfully to benefit all classes of sentient beings. That is, to care about their distant and near future and to help them by using skillful means. So skillful means is this big topic of the Buddha's teaching. And especially taught in the Lotus Sutra, where it's like there's a chapter called Skillful Means, and then there's chapters with these different parables that Buddha talks about kind of like making up stories in order to like help people who won't understand without some kind of like special method. So like there's this classic story about told in this metaphor that there's a father with a bunch of kids and in a big mansion, and the kids are all like playing with their things, totally absorbed in their play, and the house is on fire. And the father realizes it and says, "You got to come out of the house; it's burning down." And the kids just ignore him because they're so absorbed playing with their things. This is a nice metaphor for like this samsara is like the world of. Samsara is like the burning house, and we're all like kids, like caught up playing with our things. And the Buddha says, "Why don't you come out of samsara into freedom?" And we're like, no, I want to, like, I'm not done with my game. The house is burning, the fire is getting closer. And so the father in the story is like, okay, I got to like come up with something to convince them. So he says, "Hey, if you come out of the house, I have even better toys for you. I have this, like, deer cart. I have a goat cart, a deer cart, and an ox cart. They're so much fun. You can, like, you know, race them around the garden, and finally the kids are like, oh really? Some carts out there to play with? And they finally come out, and then the Buddha's like, well, actually, like, you know, I give you all these carts and more. And the metaphor is like these three vehicles that the Buddha teaches, you know, the Shravaka vehicle, the kind of like small vehicle, personal liberation vehicle, right, of like, you can have nirvana for yourself alone without being a bodhisattva. You can forget about all these people and just be free yourself. I offer that to you if you come out of the house. And then I teach this Pratika Buddha vehicle that's kind of similar. And then I teach this bodhisattva vehicle that's like even greater because it's about the freedom and liberation of all beings. But it doesn't matter which cart you come out for. When you come out, then the Buddha teaches the one vehicle that's like includes the goat cart, the deer cart, and the ox cart. And the one vehicle is just like nirvana, freedom. It doesn't matter all your ideas about whether it's for you or others. They're all included in this one big one vehicle that can, with no distinctions. And so, but if you just tell these kids about this one vehicle, they actually maybe would like to just play in their goat cart. Because maybe the goat cart is like easier to ride than the ox cart, and it goes really fast, and it's very like, it doesn't involve much suffering. So like, you can have that goat cart, just come out. And then really the goat cart, if you start riding in the goat cart, you're going to see that it's really the one vehicle anyway. So this is an example of skillful means. It's like devising some method to help people. So maybe bodhisattvas bring up like Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, even though it's not in the Buddhist sutras, just as a skillful means to help people or something like this. You could use anything that would be beneficial. In ancient times, someone helped a caged tortoise. Another took care of an injured sparrow. And so these are the, you know, old legends from these old Chinese books that Dogen was fond of, all these ancient stories. And so one of them is that Kongyu in ancient China pitied a caged tortoise and bought it and freed it. So sometimes we like pity caged crickets, mm-hmm. and we buy them and free them. We just, when we pity them. And later, he was appointed like a governor, and when he had his official seal cast, maybe like a bronze seal or something, the shape of a tortoise came out. He then knew that he had attained his position through the help of the tortoise. So these old kind of magical stories, right? You help the tortoise, and then it's kind of magically the tortoise actually helps you become like the governor, and then to show you secretly that he helped you, the seal looks like a tortoise. So, and then this other ancient Chinese person, Yangbo of the later Han Dynasty, tended to an injured sparrow. Later the sparrow appeared in his dream and said he was a messenger of Grandmother Qi, a sorcerer, and left four white rings. Then Yangbo's family flourished for four generations. Sounds like something out of like Lord of the Rings or something. So, I think Dogen's pointing out these old sort of folk stories just to say that we just benefit without thought of reward, but then often good things come. Maybe just happiness comes from benefiting others. Is enough, actually.
The act is its own best
reward. Yeah. Virtue is its own reward, we say. Yeah. It's joyful to help And the more we want something in return, the less joyful it is, actually.
To want is to suffer.
Yeah. So, they did not expect a reward. They were moved to do so only for the sake of beneficial action. And yesterday we did this cricket release with hundreds of crickets and worms around the temple here. And it was joyful. I think everybody who participated seemed like they very much enjoyed this this activity of taking these kind of boxed-in beings that lived their whole life in this enclosed, narrow space and with an impending death, and they just, their box was opened into like big, vast space. And I don't know what the crickets felt, but I felt like kind of spacious watching them hop away in the 10 directions. So, foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost, but this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, or literally says, is an act of one dharma, benefiting self and others together. To greet petitioners, a lord of old in ancient China three times stopped in the middle of his bath and arranged his hair, and three times left his dinner table. He did this solely with the intention of benefiting others. He did not mind instructing even subjects of other lords. So this is the story of someone who had lived a very comfortable life and but was very devoted to others. So he had a nice bathtub, and he was in there all kind of soaked up and in this bubble bath or something and totally relaxed. But then like some, you know, subject who he was responsible for their welfare came and knocked on the door, and instead of saying, can you send them away and like ask them to come back after my bath, he got out of the bath and to greet this person in a dignified way, tied up his top knot and did his hair and got dressed and said, yes, can I help you? And then did their little interaction, went back to the bath, and then so three times he like got up from the bath, dried off, and same, and then he was later at the dinner table, just about to stab his potato, pick it up with chopsticks, I mean. And okay, don't tell them I'm in the middle of my meal and come back later. I'll just get up and go attend to these people. So basically about being willing to be interrupted, which I think is a very challenging practice. We're doing something we're really involved in, and somebody wants something, and we're willing to like let go of what we want to do.
Being a mother.
Yeah, being a mother. Mm-hmm. One time, my teacher Sokhne Rinpoche told this story of like, this is like an example of like the Bodhisattva's heart is like, you know, it's the end of a long week, and you're really tired, and you're finally relaxed with your partner, and you're like, put on a movie you've been waiting to watch, and you even have some popcorn, and nothing to do, the week's over, and the phone rings, and it's like, you know, a friend, but maybe not even a close friend, someone that you know a little bit, but they're like, there's nobody else now, it's late at night, I'm feeling like some funny, like, I feel a little funny in my body, and I don't have a car, can you drive me to the hospital? And the hospital, I think this maybe was like a true story, because he lives in Crestone, Colorado, so the nearest hospital is like 5 hours. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's, I really need to go, but like, maybe it's a heart thing or something. And then, you know, you're like, what are you going to do? You get up, you really don't want to, actually. I mean, that's part of the Bodhisattva practice, is you really don't want to. It's not like, oh, and I'm so happy to help them to interrupt my movie and evening of relaxation. No, I don't want to, but like, I do want to, right? It's my vow. It's my practice. So get up at like halfway there after 2.5 hours. Say, actually, I'm feeling kind of better now, actually. Maybe it was just heartburn. I think I don't really need to go. I'm so sorry. Let's just go back. Okay. I thought that was a great visual image of this kind of like, maybe harder than even getting up out of your bath to just attend to some business temporarily. Willing to be interrupted.
I have a question.
Yes.
Being a Catholic. sometimes you do that, and sometimes you just really can't. You have already been interrupted.
Yeah.
Too many times. I used to say, I was a great mother for 18 hours. And like after, in the 19th hour, I was not so...
Yeah, we have our limits.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so how do you, when that happens, sometimes you just have to say no without feeling guilty.
Yeah, I think to be totally honest and, you know our limits, because part of the principle of giving too is if you give something and regret it, it's actually worse mm-hmm. than not giving it. Actually, so if you can't really, really give it, and you just kind of grudgingly, I think better not to and be really honest. And then it's like kind of a confession we do to ourselves, and like, this is my limit on this bodhisattva path, is 18 hours. And 19 is actually over the top. And maybe we even say in our better moments, and I aspire to be like, ready 24 hours. I may not get there, but like...
What if you choose to cease believing in your limits because they would only be self-imposed?
Yeah, if that's possible. Because it's true that limits are...
always and exclusively self-imposed.
But again, I would bring up this issue of... I would put it in terms of karma. Of like, you could say it's self-imposed, I think... But the karma is kind of like, maybe another way to say it, to kind of combine these things, is like that, the Buddha's teaching of no self, you probably know, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, there isn't really like an individual self, but there's stuff happening all the time. And what is that stuff that's happening? It's just conditioned activity. And what is it conditioned by? Well, our basically karma, our past activities, and this includes like our vows, which are, you could distinguish between karma is just being like driven by habit, and vow would be like, you know, kind of an intention to go beyond a habit. But both of those are conditioned. Like karma arises from conditions and vows arise from conditions, and there's not really a self that decides.
From my perspective, not having any formal training, just pursuing the nature of reality, it would seem, since I only could know of reality what my thoughts are at this moment, no previous action of vowing could influence my thoughts at this moment. They are exclusively my domain.
I think that the experience in the moment is, it's just this moment, and there is no past. And I think that the Buddha would say this too, is like, in our direct experience, in really direct experience, there's only this moment. But then he said, but actually, if you look at how, so if you want to kind of analyze and find out like how you got to sit on this particular seat in this particular room, there are conditions for that. We can trace back in, they're kind of like in past memory, like, well, I like found the address of this place and I walked here and I opened the door, so that it's not just like nothing happened before. And yet, from an experiential perspective, it is like there's just this moment.
Absolutely. You are once again only limited to the past if you choose to place that limitation upon yourself.
But this choice,
accept mindfulness in its completeness, I think you've escaped all of that.
But even if you say, choose to accept it or accept it, then we have the question, who chooses it?
The Spirit.
I love that question.
It's the Spirit. It's you're thinking the thoughts. You're perceiving, you're an ego perceiving thoughts that your Spirit is having, and your ego gets to influence
what
these thoughts are, and some never escape the thoughts of the ego. But it doesn't mean it's not the Spirit experiencing them.
What's the Spirit?
The Spirit is what you have left when the ego is gone.
Hmm. So maybe in the Buddha's language, we might call it Buddha nature. It's just like the vast being.
It's being in the now. Being without delusion.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a perception of past or future.
Mm-hmm. So we could say that that's what decides. If there's no past conditioning,
that's right.
That kind of blocks it.
You can liberate it.
But again,
you accept perfect mindfulness at least.
But you accept it, meaning like the Spirit accepts it.
Yes. Well,
Spirit accepts itself.
You find awareness that whether you accepted control over your thoughts or not, you still had control over your thoughts. You just weren't being mindful of them.
Again, this you have control. To clarify that, you mean like Spirit?
Your Spirit has control, yes.
Over itself.
Yes. There's no one else driving you. There's just...
If we're in that realm or that awareness where there's just Spirit, or if I'm understanding it right, like what we maybe say would Buddha nature, and there's nothing else, then things could function like that without conditioning.
Yes.
Sometimes we might notice some things do arise due to conditions.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, yeah. So in the conventional sense, we're here due to conditions. Like you found out where the place was and came in, and those were like conditions to lead to this moment. And so sometimes that conditioning is like is diluted. Right? It's like
always.
Based. Yeah, yeah, always you could say.
If you're letting it influence you, you aren't appreciating the now, so you're not in the real, which makes you in delusion.
Or you could say you're really in it, in reality, but it seems like the conditioning is like blocking that vision. So,
if you wish to put it that way.
Thus, you should benefit friend and enemy equally. You should benefit self and others alike. If you have this mind, even beneficial action for the sake of grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This is kind of what we've been talking about here. Is self and others, there's no difference. And if you have this mind, then beneficial action, not just for the sake of even sentient beings in the six realms, but also grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This being so, make a wholehearted effort to help the ignorant. And I thought, in a practical sense, this beneficial action for grasses, trees, wind, and water, we could take it in a modern day context of like the environment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like not, you could say really it's about the living beings in the environment, that it's really what we care about when we're talking about environmental protection. It's not so much like the rocks that we're trying to protect actually, but in this larger context, it's you could see it's all just one whole, and we want to live in harmony with this whole, that even the wind, we want to live in harmony with the wind and the rain and the rocks and sun and stars and planets and space. Or we could say, we are in harmony with all of that already, but we want to have our, you know, body, speech, and mind conduct, like, lined up with reality. Yeah, so...
That's my objective.
But if you're not coming from conditioning, then why need an objective?
Because I've experienced liberation for short periods, and I would like to maintain it.
So there's times when it's not?
Yes.
So that would be the conditioned part, right? Would you say?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I still have ego.
Okay, yeah. So there's times when, basically we just forget, yeah.
It never causes me suffering, but I still have ego. Hmm.
I think, from some of the Buddha's most subtle teachings, he would say, I think sometimes we hear it like that, that you can still have a strong sense of self, but it doesn't cause suffering. But on a kind of deeper level, sometimes we hear teachings that are like, even just to have that sense, because that sense means that, like, there's a self that's separate from others, even if it's not, like, causing kind of sort of blatant, gross kind of suffering, just that very sense is a little bit uneasy. It's a little bit off.
It's preventing liberation.
Yeah.
Still perceiving.
Yeah. So in that way, we call it, like, suffering, but not big suffering. Just a little, like, it's a little off.
It's the state of not being in liberation, but I don't feel any suffering from it.
But usually that's what we call, is it liberation.
From suffering.
Yeah, from suffering. That's what it means. And then there's like bondage, or like kind of like being bound by karmic conditioning. But sometimes I think the word suffering is a too heavy a word, because a lot of people I think feel like, well, I don't really suffer so much. But in terms of like this low-level discontent, off-kilter, yeah. Like the word dukkha, a Sanskrit word for suffering, means like a wheel that where the axle is a little bit out of balance, so it doesn't roll so smoothly. And, you know, maybe to use the English word suffering for that is too big a word. I like the word discontent, or, you know, not completely content, at least some of the time. And that's what we're working on. And then if we have like really big, like horrific, traumatic suffering, then that's same thing, but just a huge, just a very strong version of the same thing, based on that sense, illusory sense of self and other being separate.
I have a much easier time with the big suffering, dealing with it.
Yeah,
it's little stuff just sort of niggles at you.
Yeah,
just I find that's the hardest.
I think so. Mm-hmm. That's why we start with the bigger stuff, and then we kind of, and I think we do find in practice, the bigger stuff becomes less and less suffering, becomes easier, and then the more we're, especially in deep zazen, or like, you know, in a sesshin or something, I think that's when we really can get into like the subtle discontent. Like everything's going well, my life's perfectly flowing quite fine. I just had a great meal. I'm sitting here. I'm actually comfortable. But actually when I get really into like the heart of my being, something's like slightly off. What is that? Maybe we can't even quite identify, but maybe it's that if we feel that, I think it's often just that slight sense of that I feel like I'm here, and it's not, I know it's not really true. I'm not really here, but like I feel like I'm here, and that sense of like me and the room that I'm in is like a little bit separate. It's like if you're really deeply settled, that can be like excruciating. Maybe not excruciating, but like I think we do work on like go from the gross to the subtle suffering. Or you could say any conceptual thought is like slightly suffer, slightly discontent.
Because you've gotten a glimpse of the other.
Yeah. then you know that when there's no conceptual thought at all, conceptual thought is what creates the sense of ego or self and other. So if there's not conceptual thought, we're just like resting, could be just resting in reality. And the slightest thought comes of like, even the thought like, maybe this is like perfect nirvana. And that very thought is like destroys it. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You can only maintain the timeless state while your thoughts aren't changing.
Yeah. And then, of course, we also have the in the non-dual traditions, the even more subtle realization that the reality realm isn't actually really hindered by thought. So then you can see if the thought is like a kind of magical display that's not really real, but is still appearing. In this non-moving, non-thinking ground, then maybe also liberation, which seems like something like that must be possible. Otherwise, the Buddha could never have spoken, or he would have lost his liberation as soon as he opened his mouth. But we hear that that's not really true. So...
I lose my liberation when I try to relate to others who don't have liberation to communicate with them.
I lose liberation when
I try to...
Talking about it is one of the hardest. Talking about anything is very hard to stay like really free of the sense of separation when we're interacting with others, especially with speech. Yeah. Very challenging, yeah. Yeah, impossible, but challenging. So a great practice while talking and interacting to see if we can like not kind of like solidify that separation that seems so tangible. And we reinforce it in a conversation with two people. We're reinforcing the self and other thing just by like the nature of a conversation. So it may be possible to, and I think this is one possible way to look at Dokusan in the Zen tradition is, and maybe like koan practice is like, is it possible to like, have this meeting that's so present and direct and like non kind of like usual discursiveness, that it's just being as one person in a way, but then words can kind of come out and there can be a meeting without like that separation. Maybe possible to, I think Zen has ways of exploring that. And that's why those conversations seem so strange when you read them in the koan collections. They're not like your usual conversations. Like, this person asked this, but this one comes back with an answer that seems to like have nothing to do with the question. But because they're like not, because if they're like, they asked me a question, what should I answer now to, what would be the right answer to that? Then you're into this separation thing. But if it's more like, blip, just expression, and then expression, and then another one, and then like that's so dynamic that it's like if either one falls into like is there, am I saying it right? Then we lose it, right?
If you believe there's a right,
yeah, well that's the thing,
then you failed it.
You know, it's, that's right, yeah, if we believe there's a right, we fail it. Yeah, if we get, we're into the right and wrong,
it means you're already fear motivated too.
Yeah.
Looking for doing right.
In fact, the koan that I'm intending to bring up this Wednesday is about this issue of right and wrong. The story itself brings up this issue of falling into right and wrong. So it's kind of really getting at this point.
What's the translation of Dokusan?
Alone meeting. So I think it, yeah. So, you know, in a practical sense, I think it maybe came from, like, there's certain kind of, you know, in the Zen temples, there were dialogues that are group. Like, there's a kind of a teacher talking with a group, and they're asking questions and answers in the group. And those are called, like, shosan and stuff. And then dokusan is, like, when you're just doing an individual meeting. So this is a very practical sense of, it's a one-on-one meeting, but it's got this kind of double meaning in Zen of, like, yeah, it's a lone meeting, like individual meaning, like there's just one person meeting. So it's nice that it has that kind of practical explanation of what it is, and then it has this maybe inner meaning of, like, there's nobody else there, actually.
That's beautiful.
Dokusan. Any other questions about beneficial action? In Asanga's Indian text, when he talks about this, it's like it's like action that inspires others, and particularly it's connected with these paramitas of, like, giving and harmless conduct and patience and enthusiasm and concentration and wisdom, these six paramitas, activities of the Bodhisattva. In the early Indian texts, are like, what is kind speech? Kind speech is teaching these six paramitas. What is beneficial conduct? It's practicing these six paramitas and inspiring others to practice them. And then the last one, this identity action, is like practicing them in order to, like, just be in accord with what one is teaching, or setting the example, which is maybe the same practice, but one is to just inspire and encourage others, and one is to, like, set the example, which also inspires and encourages others, but it's more like to just be in accord, which is why it's called identity action.
I read one translation that they used the word cooperation.
Yeah, cooperation. Mm-hmm.
But is it quite, and you haven't gone into the first line, but that's a little less intense than non-difference from others.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, it is. It's a more practical.
Yeah.
Just cooperating, being in harmony. When something needs to be done, we try to maybe compromise and live in harmony. And Dogen comments on it a little bit like that. But again, this is the one that in the original Indian sutras, I think has this meaning that Dogen doesn't really pick up on at all, which is like practicing what one preaches, or like being in accord with what one says. Not being hypocritical, you could say. And that's not really how Dogen does this. But it looks like that's the original meaning. So identity action, setting the example, non-hypocrisy, so on. So, sure, if there's nothing else, we jump into this one, yeah? Keep going. I think this is the most radical, maybe. You know, giving, kind speech, and beneficial action are pretty straightforward. Identity action means non-difference. Or other translations say, identity action is not being contrary. Or it means non-opposition. It is non-difference from self, non-difference from others. Or again, you could say, it's not opposing self, not opposing others. So in that way, you could say it could be like the same as this original meaning of, like, being in accord with what one says, living in accord with one's words, being not different from oneself, particularly. Yeah, walking your talk. Not being different from what one says one is, maybe. And then non-difference from others. For example, in the human world, the Tathagata, the Buddha, took the form of a human being. Or there's the character for same that's used in the identity or sameness action. So it took the identical or same form as a human being. From this we know that he did the same in other realms. So you could hear this as the Buddha is this, you know, beyond all limitations, beyond being a human or a non-human, is beyond anything we can possibly imagine. And yet, that Buddha, that vast, inconceivable, ineffable awakenedness, took the form of a human being. So it's kind of like when we get into these three bodies of Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the reality body of the Buddha has no form, and then it manifests as this Nirmanakaya, as a manifestation body that looks like this person that lived in India around 500 BC and walked around with a robe and a bowl and like taught these sutras. Right? But that's from the great vehicle perspective, it's like that his human body is like a manifestation of the reality body of Buddha, which is like, you could say, God the Father took the form of the Son, Christ, who could teach as a human being and live the way of harmony with others in this world. Very similar.
Yeah, I was thinking the language sounds like...
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Straight up.
In the human world, yeah, the Buddha took the form of a human being.
Or, but the other thing you said is the Buddha could also manifest...
And I thought this was interesting.
We believe that also.
Yeah, from this we know that he did the same in other realms.
Yes.
And so I think I would understand this, you know, these six realms of sentient beings. So these human realm, the devas, those like invisible celestial beings, and then the kind of jealous devas, who, like the wannabe devas, because devas, like, they live super long time and they're very blissful. So there's some who are like, not quite devas, but they're fighting, trying to get into the deva realm, knocking at the doors of the deva realm with their shooting, you know, arrows and stuff in the image of this. And then the humans, the animal realm, and the hell beings, and the hungry ghosts. And so these six realms of sentient beings that all represent these different emotional qualities. But, you know, in the old Indian teachings, they're taken quite literally as that there are these realms. And that the Buddha, so this vast Dharma body of Buddha can manifest in all these realms. And sometimes when you see the paintings, you really just, I think Tibetan Buddhism is maybe the ones who invented the wheel of the six realms. They have the pictures of these six realms, and they often there's a Buddha standing in each of the six, you know, quadrants, six sections. So we know of Shakyamuni Buddha in the human realm, but maybe there's a Buddha by a different name and a different appearance in the animal realm. Maybe it takes the form of an animal. Maybe each species of animal has their own Buddhas. So because this transformation, manifestation body can enter all realms, and bodhisattvas can too, like Jizo Bodhisattva can like enter these non-human realms in order to like help liberate beings there. So this is like, and this is a commentary on this identity action, which is kind of nice, right? That the form, which is kind of an illusion, that there's humans and animals and these forms are not really, from an ultimate perspective, there aren't really humans and animals and hungry ghosts, right? But the Buddha can take these forms in order to cooperate or to be completely identify with these beings to help them. Because we can't, like, the Dharmakaya actually doesn't really teach, can't really help us. It's just what it is. We're like in it all the time, but it doesn't really help us except when it takes some form that we can relate to. even like you could say maybe zazen, maybe like the really deeply peaceful, joyful self-enjoyment samadhi or dogen, maybe we could connect with like the Sambhogakaya, that's like the bliss body of Buddha. And that's a little different than the Dharma body is just has no, doesn't have bliss even. It doesn't have, doesn't, we can't even call it peace. It's has no characteristics. But the maybe the joy, the natural joy of dropping off body and mind in zazen could be called the Sambhogakaya, and it's there, it's to teach us something about the reality body, but it's still taking a slight form. It's not taking the form of like a human yet. It's just taking the form of bliss. So it's called the bliss body. Maybe that's one way to look at Sambhogakaya.
If you make all your thoughts in the now on bliss, you become bliss.
The mind is very powerful and can create anything.
It's all you could know of power and creation. It's what you think of power and creation.
Yeah. And it's also powerful in that it has these aspects of like, you know, this veiling aspect that blocks that total creativity sometimes, right, due to conditions. That's powerful part of mind too. Karma is like incredibly powerful. The Buddha says all beings are heirs of their karma, there's no way to escape the effects of our actions. That's like super powerful too. You say maybe identically as powerful as the Buddha mind that's completely free from all cause and effect. So all of it is amazingly boundless.
Absolutely. There would only be a limitation if you chose to believe in it.
And sometimes we do. And therefore, that belief in it is very powerful too. We know that identity, action, others and self are one. Or literally it says, self and others are one suchness. Suchness is like, thus the way things are, beyond all our ideas. Self and others are one suchness. When we know identity, action. So now there's a strange part here. Lute, song, and wine are one with human being, deva, and spirit being.
Is that supposedly a one-to-one correlation?
No, I don't think so. I think because now he's just going to play with all these interconnectedness, exactly. But the apparently this is there's this there's one Taoist, ancient Taoist text in China that says that lute, song or poetry, it would be another translation, and wine are the three friends of a hermit. So I think, you know, these Taoist hermits were maybe like very, sometimes the romantic portrait of them is like, they're just very carefree. They're just wandering with nothing, but they love poetry and song and some sake maybe, and that's one picture of these, of the ancient Taoists, kind of like crazy yogis. And and then there's this poem that this actually refers to. It's some ancient Taoist poem that's called the Poem of the Three Comrades at the Northern Window. And it goes, who are the three comrades? Lute stopped playing. Wine is raised up. When wine is finished, a song is sung. The three comrades lead one another, going round and round endlessly.
So he knew this poem.
I think, I guess so. And maybe it was common in Dogen's time. Other people knew this. Maybe it was a famous poem at its time. But the image is like the three comrades are lute, wine, and song. And so the image here is that they're playing together, and there's probably people there too. Right? But to make a toast with wine. Stop the song for a minute. I have a toast to make to the Tao. So lute stops playing in order for wine to be raised. And then when the wine is finished, then now it's time for a song. The three comrades lead one another going round and round endlessly. So it's this interaction of these three like non-animate things. It sounds like, but they don't interrupt each other, right? Lute stops playing, and the wine is raised, and then when the wine is finished, then the song is sung, and round and round. So it's like this, I hear Dogen playing with this as an image of dependent co-arising. It's that these three activities, and it's such a strange image out of the blue here, but these maybe also very like ordinary, not holy activity. Is just maybe we could say also like the natural activity of these wandering Taoist hermits. That's the portrayal of them is they're not super disciplined, practitioners. Following a strict course, they're just kind of like having a party in the mountains. And that's the way that they live, this carefree, natural way. And maybe that's the expression here, is that the whole world is this natural, carefree, interactive, arising beyond like figuring out a bunch of decisions. Well, let's see, I have a toast to make, but like, should I interrupt the lute song to make it or not? It's more like, oh, the song finished, I'll make a toast. Or almost like, as one's raising the glass, the lute player stops the song. Oh, you have a toast? It's almost like a non-verbal, uncontrived interaction is how I hear this. So Dogen says, lute, song, and wine are one with human being, deva, and spirit being. So, human being, deva, and spirit is like a kami in Japan. Like, so they're like devas, but they're particularly Japanese kind of nature spirits, we might say. And maybe they're like mountain spirits, and they're so. If these Taoist hermits are off in the mountains, they're also dancing around and enjoying life with the mountain spirits and the devas invisibly, and those three are all interacting. It could be that the room right now is filled with devas. In the old sutras, the Buddha sometimes says, he's giving a Dharma talk to the human assembly, and he says, by the way, you might not notice this, but like this assembly hall right now is like filled with devas, and they're like, you wouldn't believe how colorful they are. They're all dressed in like red and blue, and they're, you might not see them, but the Buddha could like, his mind is just very open to these other realms. So, and they're maybe interacting all the time. Lute, song, and wine are one. And another translation is, lute, song, and wine make friends with human being, deva, and spirit. Another translation is, lute, song, and wine keep company with humans, devas, and spirits. So whether it's one with, making friends with, keeping company with, I hear this as a poetic kind of expression of just natural and uncontrived, interdependent relationship. This is an expression of this identity action. So, lute, song, and wine are one with human being, deva, and spirit being. Human being is one with lute, song, and wine. Lute, song, and wine are one with lute, song, and wine. Human being is one with human being. Deva is one with deva. Spirit being is one with spirit being. To understand this is to understand identity action. This kind of classic Dogen, taking a list and looking at all the permutations of every possible relationship with everything else.
Recognizing oneness.
Yeah, recognizing oneness. Oneness within differentiation. Of there's lutes, there's songs, and there's wine, and that interaction is just one.
I think when
oneness.
You differentiate oneness, you are creating the delusion of separation.
Sometimes. Or maybe we'd even say usually. But then there could be the integration of oneness and differentiation, which is not deluded in the Zen teachings. Sometimes they talk about the kind of like Zen sickness is sometimes described as like falling into oneness and kind of like ignoring differentiation. So in Zen, there's a lot of emphasis on like the complete integration of the many and the one, or difference and unity, in a non-deluded way.
And are you talking about the two truths?
Yeah.
You're saying that?
Yeah, the two truths.
I'm trying to make sure I start learning
some of these. Because the two truths are like the appearance of interdependent phenomena, like lute, song, and wine, as the conventional truth. The appearance of interdependent phenomena, and then the ultimate truth is vast oneness with no appearances at all. And those, like that oneness appears interdependently as floors, walls, and ceilings, and me and you. And it's, we say it's conventional truth because it's mere appearance arising according to conditions. But there's nothing more than a momentary flash of appearance of me and you, intricately arisen, dependent on conditions. Whereas, so those are the two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. And then there's like non-truth. Because these two are truths, but non-truth would be like not just the mere appearance of phenomena, but actually real, solid, like this really is the floor, and this really is me and you, and we really are separate. You could say that's not even the conventional truth, that's just like non-truth, or just like...
it's an artifact of perception.
Yeah. So it's like when we reify the conventional truth, it becomes non-truth. But just the mere appearance of a momentary arising is, we can call that a truth. Actually, it's true, conventionally speaking.
But the ultimate truth is there's only the thought in your mind at this infinitesimal small moment of now.
Well, maybe more strictly speaking, we'd say the ultimate truth is that there aren't any thoughts. I would say that the infinitesimal thought of the moment is actually still a conventional truth. And actually, the ultimate truth is that there isn't any thought. There's nothing that we can name at all, even thought.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's something that's difficult to express in words.
Actually, it's impossible to express in words. That's part of the definition of the ultimate truth.
But nothing worth knowing is expressible in words, I've found. It makes communication difficult sometimes. If you wish to convey something with knowing.
Yeah, there may be some things still worth knowing that can be communicated in words, but just they're not ultimate.
That's right.
And yet we spend a lot of time with words, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah,
we do.
Those books.
Yeah, a lot of words. And it's nice that we also have a lot of like zazen, mm-hmm. where we just stop talking and sit and
that's
drop
your,
it.
That's your moment of capability to appreciate truth.
Yeah, of just sitting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Recognizing the oneness as your thoughts and full control over it means you've achieved it, I think.
Well, something's out there, but there's also crickets out there, right?
There's crickets.
Oh, that's right. Those are like crickets.
Could be.
The skunk, he's a very brave. And the skunk that will just like, we were doing kinkin.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that is brave.
What was that?
It was some, might have been like the New Year's thing where it was like really late.
Oh, a while ago.
Yeah, no, and I totally believe that because, you know, animals will respond to the kind of internal anxiety that's going on with the person. And if people are walking in kinkin, they're walking calmly, quietly, and just, you know, with the energy is way subdued, and the animals will get closer to you when you're like that, and they'll stay further away.
And it may be that to walk kinkin and let a skunk walk through like that could be beneficial action that will create an imprint in that skunk for future lives to kind of connect with practice.
It would be impossible for it not to make an influence on the skunk's life.
Yeah, that's true.
I had the treat of petting a rattlesnake in Utah not too long ago.
Mm.
I saw it in the road, and I approached it with only thoughts of love.
Well,
and it was completely calm.
It's impossible for that not to have an imprint.
I was able to pet it, and it had no reaction other than to smell me.
Wonderful.
It was amazing.
Therefore, all the positive energy and merit gathered from all our giving, kind speech, beneficial actions, and inconceivable identity action, and the conversation tonight be gathered up and dedicated to all living beings in all realms everywhere. May they be free from all their perceived limitations. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.